Welcome to the Entrepreneur's Logbook podcast, where we uncover the strategies and the insights driving extraordinary business growth. Today, we're joined by Michael Brainerd, CEO and founder of Brainerd Strategy, a management consulting firm transforming leaders and organization through innovative leadership, organizational, and strategy development. With over 20 years of experience as a management consultant, senior executive, and researcher, Michael has dedicated his career to understanding the psychological principle behind effective leadership. He's also the author of How to Become an Effective Leader, 8 Disciplines to Accelerate Your Executive Leadership, and has delivered his groundbreaking work on the bias trifecta to numerous organizations worldwide, including conducting his own TED Talk. Michael, it's great to have you on the show.
Great. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to our conversation.
Great. Just to like kick things off, could you just give everyone a bit of like background as far as like how you got into space? I know you've been doing this for like quite a while, but I'd love to talk to you in your own words here.
Yeah, so it's kind of a semi-interesting story, at least for me. I really didn't know what industrial and organizational psychology was. I didn't know. I came out of undergrad and I tried my hand at an athletic career, which was short-lived. And I had a friend who was dissuading me from getting my MBA when I was thinking about going to graduate school. And he introduced me to this thing called IO psychology, and it was very simple. He said, it's kind of business and psychology mixed, and you're working on the people and the process side of helping corporations better employees' lives and leaders' lives. And with that simple definition, I thought, that sounds interesting. So I put some applications out, and lo and behold, I got into the Illinois Institute of Technology, and I finished my PhD at Alliant International University here in Southern California. So it was really just my interest in the coursework and the academic pursuits. I actually thought about just becoming a researcher and not becoming a practitioner. But during graduate school, I had a couple of really interesting internships, and that led to jobs. And this field of organizational behavior and leadership development still fascinates me to this day. So I must have made the right choice as a young person.
I mean, you've been doing it for 20 years, so I think you probably made the right choice and you seem to absolutely be loving it, having even done like some TED Talks. And I think that's probably one thing I was actually like a bit interested in, because you made that TED Talk, I think like 7 years ago, if I'm not totally mistaken. I think that was in like Irvine, like California, something like that.
Right, and UCI, correct.
And yeah, there you go. And with like your work on like the bias effect, I mean, it did get like a pretty decent amount of like attention with you obviously giving like that TED Talk. What, I guess, like led you to like discover like these 3 specific like biases, and how did you like start seeing like their impact on like leadership, like decision making here?
So that's right. That last part is right. I didn't come from a diversity, equity, and inclusion perspective. I'm obviously a white male, and I actually became interested in cognitive biases through the original work I've done with teams in team development, strategic planning, and helping organizations prepare for large change events. What I noticed that was the really smart, otherwise well-intended leaders would often make mistakes in their decision-making based on predefined or pre-experienced behaviors. And I thought, that seems a bit silly for a sophisticated thinker to be sort of missing something or having blind spots or being overly drawn toward what made them comfortable. So I started reading the academic sort of literature around how cognitive biases work. And it's certainly not my original thinking, but what I discovered were 3 specific biases seem to be working in a linear fashion during the decision-making or judgment-making process. So I got very interested, frankly, in the neurobiological basis for these biases. Like, they don't just exist on their own. Where do they come from? How did they get to be a part of the human condition, regardless of your gender, your race, your ethnicity, class, country of origin? Regardless of all of that, humans seem to be struggling with getting over certain cognitive biases. And it's just the expression of the manifestation could be in judgment and decision-making around business decisions, could be judgment and beliefs about different kinds of people. So we see these biases affect every aspect of the human condition. And I just thought when I discovered these 3 working together, that's what got me excited to put it into a paper and eventually a TED Talk.
Yeah. So you're basically saying that like everyone experiences like these biases in like their own way, but it's like all different. And it somewhat comes from like past experience in a way, perhaps, in like some shape or form.
Yeah, it's sort of nature and nurture, if you think about it. I mean, we've evolved as Homo sapiens, and we've sort of won, right? And we became the dominant species on the planet. And that came from really being in social structures. It was our numbers and our frontal cortex, frankly, that allowed us to survive and thrive. So when we are most comfortable, we are with our tribe, our family, people that are like us, like you and I are sort of white males, and that unconscious bias really isn't firing down in the amygdala when you and I might meet at 7 p.m. on a dark street in Philadelphia. But when we get further from our own in-group, those differences seem to spark almost like a fight or flight reaction down in the amygdala, out of our awareness in an involuntary way. It's not politically correct. And that's really the origin of my bias trifecta, which is understanding how unconscious bias affects us without us even knowing, right? We're just drawn toward and attracted toward things that are familiar, comfortable, like us. And the opposite is true. And that really starts a process of errors and assumptions and judgments that may or may not always be accurate, but we can't turn off unconscious bias. It just is. We just have to understand it, understand how it works, and increase our experience set, that sort of nurture part, increase our experience set to become more comfortable with things that are less like us, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's not about like trying to get rid of like that bias in a way. It's more about trying to like understand it. And obviously everyone has a different perception around like how it perhaps appear, how they understand it, etc. It's somewhat like a blind spot in a way where you're not actually aware of it, but it is actually unconsciously like happening. And I guess like with your work with like leaders, is there a certain like strategy way that you help them? I wouldn't say like overcome it, but perhaps like help them understand it more on like a deeper level to perhaps be able to navigate it like more efficiently.
Yeah, the word I use is mitigate the impact, right? We're never going to eliminate our biases, but when we're forming judgments and we're making decisions, particularly in business, there's three biases, the bias trifecta. So once our unconscious bias gets us moving toward comfort rather than discomfort, when we're trying to make a decision or form a belief or a judgment, it's really kind of depressing because there's this bias called retroactive inference, and it exists in sort of the side of our brain where memories are held. So when we're making a decision, we're stuck by, I should say, our past experiences. We don't go out into a white space and say, objectively, what's the best decision? We look for experiences that are similar to this one. We go through what worked and didn't work in the past and then apply that. We're really stuck with our memories and experiences when making a decision. That bias is called retroactive inference. And then once we come to a point of view, the stimulus moves to our prefrontal cortex where ration and logic are, and it says confirmation bias. It says, I'm looking for evidence that I'm whole, that I'm right, that I'm good. The reason I walk through the bias trifecta is because you can't talk about mitigating it just by understanding unconscious bias. We have to understand when decision-making and forming judgments, there's really three regions in the brain that spark three different biases, and they kind of pile on each other. So I'm comfortable with what I'm comfortable with. I'm stuck with my memories and experiences when solving the problem or making the decision. And then I naturally, organic, go look for evidence that I'm smart, that I'm right, that I'm okay. Sort of the Fox News, MSNBC model. And so when mitigating the bias, think about the opposite of those things. Let's slow down and not assume that things aren't like us are going to be bad. Number two, let's understand that when making decisions, it's great to get multiple people, multiple points of view, multiple methods and frameworks, not just the one that we've used before. Allow ourselves to be challenged by not only different people, but different perspectives, different points of view. How about somebody who's got 2 years of experience? What would they say about this decision or problem versus my 22 years of experience? Not that I'll pivot either way. I just need to open up the channel with more possible inputs. We call it multi-input. And then out here, this is obvious. Instead of seeking comfort or that I might be right, why don't I seek to be wrong?
or fallible or vulnerable. And that's the work of Brené Brown and others that talk about, let's resist the need to confirm we're right. Let's challenge ourselves and get into that growth mindset. So if our leaders can be comfortable being a little uncomfortable, if they can use multiple methods and inputs to solve problems and make decisions, and they can seek to be a little less certain and comfortable, they seem to, those series of behaviors, which are hard, seem to mitigate some of the bias in our decision-making and formation of judgments.
Mm-hmm. I find that interesting.
A little long-winded there. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries. I find that interesting. So like the first thing that we will do is somewhat base a decision on like your past experience, like memories, as you can mention. And then second component is going to be like logic base where, okay, we have the memory, then we're going to look and try to like confirm our assumption, the decision that we want to make. And that's interesting because in a way, like I've seen so many people where they're going to try again, like as you mentioned, to try to confirm what they already know, but they're not going to try to go like a bit further to try to go against what they already know. And I feel like that's where when you're talking with other people that have different work experience, even if they have like 3 years, they might have gone through a specific work experience that can bring a lot of value to the table. So by being able to like first as a leader, take all these perspectives of everyone, putting them into one, and then using more of like a logic-based approach, I feel that's like much more efficient. Because if it's just one person making the decision on their own work experience, memories, then just try to confirm their own like decision they wanted to make in the first place, but not trying to get feedback from other people, then it's like this echo chamber of just what you were going to do in the first place. There's no like union perspective.
And you see this in corporate America all the time. You can use politics, that's easy. But in corporate America, you see the CEO will come, the CEO will bring in his or her team that they've used in the past, and they'll set about in the new business to use a past set of tapes to solve new problems. Not all bad. But to your point, being inclusive, being open to debate, being open to different perspectives. This is why this DE&I thing kind of melting away in our society, being eroded away, frankly, by some of our government institutions is unhealthy. It's not unhealthy just because of a racial and gender inequality that may result. It's also a diverse workforce. It gets better answers. It gets smarter products. It gets more efficiency. So we want to be open to being challenged, and we don't want to be right. We want to be better. And I say that all the time when I coach leaders, you don't want to be right. You want better. And if you can get that sort of mentality, you will be more inclusive and open to being challenged.
No, I love like the way you framed it. Like you don't want to be right. You want to be better. Because I feel like there's just this common misconception again. Like you have something in mind, you have this gut feeling, it's probably right. But it doesn't mean that you'll get better. Like it just might be what you thought was correct. But once you get more perspective, and again, I guess that even goes back to like a bit of like the data component. Like you get more perspective, you get more insights, you get more inputs. And from that, you can generate better outputs by making better decisions in a way. And I know with like your book, there was like one component I think that really talks a lot about like insecurity, ignorance as like one of like the root causes of like poor like leadership. One thing I guess I'd be really curious is how did you like come to like this realization? And like what is like the first step that leaders should take to like address these issues like head on?
Read their own business card. I'll explain.
Sure.
Ignorance. When I meet leaders, particularly mid-career leaders, they're typically advanced to leadership because they were technically bright and really great at their job. That's typically the early requirements to become a leader. Ignorance is ignoring that first phrase in your business card. Read any business card. It's level, and then function. It's vice president, finance. It's director, accounting. The idea that the organization is expecting a certain level of leadership is ignored by many high-achieving people. They're running down the hallway being excellent at their technical tasks, but yet they've been promoted from manager to senior manager to senior director. Now they have 60 or 100 people that are expecting leadership, and they're ignorant to the leadership task. Now, they're ignorant for two reasons. One, they're ignorant. They're unconsciously unaware. They're simply unaware of the responsibility and the things to do. But the other side of it is the ego and esteem comes from being technically competent. When I don't know exactly some of the leadership tools and methods and frameworks and ways I have to challenge myself emotionally to be a good leader, when I'm ignorant of those responsibilities, I'm a poor leader. This idea of insecurity, right? It works similar to, I'm very secure at doing my job, the function of my job, and I'm less secure about being fallible as a leader, about understanding we're on a journey together with our teams and people who accept leadership from us. This idea that I don't have to be perfect, I can talk to my boss who's been a leader for 20 years and be open to coaching. So insecurity would close you off to being fallible or vulnerable. A secure person, a secure leader would say, of course I don't have all the answers. Criticize me. I'm here to get better. And this idea of a growth mindset, we want leaders throughout their career, 60s, into their 70s if they're in the workforce. How do you become less certain? How do you become aware that you are a leader? And leadership requires time and diligence and effort. So insecurity and ignorance, to me, have been the cornerstones or foundations of highly ineffective leaders. So before we get to the fancy stuff of becoming a better leader, let's work on ourselves. It's right, right? It's a bit of a paradox. To be a better leader, let's start with, are we secure in what we're doing? Do we have to be perfect? Am I aware that 3 or 30 people expect me to show up as a responsible coach and leader every day? This is the kind of thing that we want to offset before we get into the mechanics of coaching and building high performance teams and strategic thinking and decision making and all that other stuff that does require education and experience. We've got to start with ourselves to engender willing, engaged teams and individuals.
Yeah, so like when you look at like people that take on like a new like leadership role, like some of them, again, as you mentioned, they've been like so head on in like the weeds of just doing the work, and they don't even realize they've been promoted to a leadership level for a reason. And I guess that somewhat goes back to even like just the top, like the leadership team deciding for like new leadership position. Like they have to make sure that that person will actually be a good leader, but even if they're not, you can obviously develop that work on that. But it goes back to first being aware that you're like a leader and taking some like accountability for that. And I guess like what you were mentioning with like the ignore insight component, I feel like that somewhat ties a bit into like the educational component, that you should always want to like educate yourself, be better. And if you just try to stick in like your little own bubble when you have people relying on you, then you're doing like a disservice to like the entire organization and even for like yourself. So if you can't perform as a leader, you're probably not going to stay as a leader for long.
That's exactly right. And the really high-performing organization, small, medium, and large, will institutionalize leadership development. In other words, a startup might not, right? But a mature organization will say, hey, if you're going to become a manager, these are the requirements. These are the competencies. These are the training that's available at the director, vice president level. So we at Brainerd Strategy obviously partner with organizations to help them institutionalize the various service offerings for their own internal leaders, and even provide those services. But putting that aside, you'll find that some organizations that don't do that leave it to us, right? To educate ourselves, to challenge ourselves. And frankly, you know, a lot of us are running hard and maybe skip those steps at times.
Just forget about it completely. And like we were obviously talking about like the insecurity ignorance component, and I feel that somewhat ties into like EQ, like obviously emotional intelligence. Like it is a crucial component for like leadership, like development. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but do you have like any, I guess, like stories where you've seen a leader like improve like their EQ and like it drastically just change like the entire organization as a whole? Or
yeah, I mean, I've got enough war stories to bore you and your audience forever. I'll share one. So when I think about EQ, I think about Goleman's model: self-awareness, self-motivation, self-regulation, empathy, and relationship building. And I think about, I'll just take one leader, a chief operating officer in a manufacturing organization. Very, very stressful job, quality control issues. CEO asked me to work with the COO from a coaching perspective because there were some leadership challenges that were bubbling up through the organization. We offered a 360 assessment early in our coaching relationship and found that this person lacked severely on the self-regulation and the self-awareness components, severely. this person would lose his cool and think it was acceptable and had no impact on others. He didn't even realize that he couldn't play poker. His face would get red when he would be frustrated and people would instantly shut down. And then he wouldn't understand why people weren't coming to him early with problems, that he was having to uncover problems. We could then specifically target self-awareness exercises, activities, getting him to be more self-regulating, understanding his internal emotional state earlier, purposely managing that differently with different techniques over a period of months, not overnight. This person's, we'll call him Tom, which would have, we would get feedback because he understood the importance of making changes because the CEO made it clear that we needed to make some changes. So we started just with his direct reports, not the whole manufacturing organization. And we opened up every 2 weeks. Did we see what worked and didn't work with and Tom's idea, right? I'm just a coach. We came up with the idea. But Tom's input was, why don't I get feedback from my directs every Friday just on my behavioral approach? Because I'm learning. So once we could open him up and he understood the importance of developing self-awareness and self-regulation, he was such a high-achieving person that he was really challenging himself to improve in those areas. Look, he's not going to become, you know, softer or weak. He's just developing skills that would allow information to come to him earlier, him to be less intimidating to others and be a little bit more collaborative. I saw this person over a period of 5 to 7 years sporadically in my work with the organization and other parts, just continue to get praise for his own work on himself. And that was a term that people use. So yes, emotional intelligence is developable. And we sometimes need an external coach or assessments or external and outside in feedback, so to speak, to really challenge us to want to develop those leadership skills, frankly, is what they are.
But right? it's also great to have like someone that understands that they need to be like improved. That is like self-aware, as you mentioned, like you obviously do have to like develop it, but someone that is actually open to like learning new things, being better, and actually maybe even stepping out of like their comfort zone to get to that next level. Because you can only grow if you don't. Yeah.
And to your earlier point, he might not have done it had the CEO not sat him down and said, boy, we're getting some tough feedback that's affecting the business and our people. So that outside in component early on and being open to feedback, or sometimes when you're not open to it, having a boss that understands the importance of improving these skills, now I can be on a journey. But it's hard to get started on that journey because if you don't see yourself accurately, you would have no urgency to learn.
Yeah. So you somewhat have to have like that wake up call in a way. Like you might not come to that realization, but if you have a good CEO, good leadership team, like they might tell you like, hey, we need to work on this. Like this is an issue. Yep. That's where like that outside.
It's very important to have feedback channels in organizations that are effective and so many don't.
Yeah, and I guess that even ties back into like culture, just having like really good standards, just setting that. And I guess like just touching onto like your hourglass model for like optimizing like the culture, the vision, the strategy. How did you even like come to like develop like this approach? And like what would you say makes it, I guess, like really effective for like organizations?
So one of the things that I've been able to do in my career is make complex things consumable. So what is the role of a senior leadership team in any organization? Like, where do we start? What do we do? And I argue that putting the silly acronyms together are memorable for people. So CVS, right? CVS. We as senior leaders must talk about what we expect and intend to create around culture, vision, and strategy. Those things describe to groups of humans all over the world, perhaps, culture. How are we to behave to be successful here? Vision. What is winning? What does success for all of us look like? Strategy. How will we get there? What's the game plan? So think about sort of what, how, and why. Now, Zachary, Michael Brainerd, anyone can say, this is why my effort matters. This is why I'm doing what I'm doing. We're running this type of strategy versus that type of strategy. To be successful here, we've got to be creative and challenging and conflict engaged. other cultures, we're going to be conflict averse. We're not going to give open feedback. And we don't care about creativity. Keep the trains running on time. So culture, vision, and strategy not only must be defined intentionally, they have to complement one another, right? So if winning and success looks like revenue only, well, how will that impact the culture, right? And how will that inform the strategy? Maybe it's not revenue, maybe it's profit. And I know that sounds very, very basic, but running an organization against a gross margin or an EBITDA or a profit set of metrics, it's a little bit different than running just for the revenue. So I'm just using examples, but we got to start not only with culture, vision, and strategy as entities to be defined and driven and led from, it allows people to attach their effort and their engagement to the kind of culture they enjoy, a vision that they feel good about, a strategy they can win with, right? So we have to create these things so others can fully express their talents for us and with us in the organization. Great example, obviously, Apple. There's many organizations that are started out as very purpose-driven or vision-driven and change over time. But culture, vision, and strategy, if they start to fight with one another, if they start to come in conflict with one another, we see lack of alignment. And lack of alignment in organizations leads to dysfunctional people behavior, dysfunctional processes, dysfunctional reward systems. So that alignment at the top, to me, is critical. Now, the hourglass model is just a simple model that says, if I'm a leader in any organization, I have to look up to understand and be able to translate the CVS, the culture, vision, strategy, for all of the people I lead. Now, you've seen this before. If I look up and I don't agree with the culture, vision, and or strategy, and I'm going to fight City Hall, I'm likely City Hall is going to win because culture sort of eats strategy and people up. So we want to make sure our leaders don't have to be copy and paste at all. They have to understand it, translate it, and make it exciting and engaging for their people. That's where the hourglass framework comes in.
No, I love like the way you explained it. That was really easy to like understand. And I feel that's like really important because you see like a lot of companies just like they don't really take a lot of time to like set their mission, their vision, like where they're going, principles, culture, vision, principles, and all that fun stuff. And I feel like when you don't do that, you just have less clarity like where you're going. And it's not just about just like the founder, like just knowing like where they're going. It goes back to the company, the people under you, your leadership team. If you don't have like that same like vision in like in your head that you know what you're doing, why you're doing it, for like which purpose, there's like this misalignment in a way where some people just have no clue what they're doing and why they're doing it. But once you have a better understanding like where you're doing something, then it's much more easier to work towards that goal, know what your efforts are actually doing to get to that goal in the end. And it's just about like teamwork in the end. Like people feel more like fulfilled in a way because they're actually contributing to the vision in a way. So I love that. And I think like one of the other thing I'd really love to hear your take, because you've been doing this for like quite a while and you've seen probably a lot of technical like crisis and all that fun stuff. And you've seen like all this stuff with like AI recently just like come up, and there's like even people using it to like train themselves and like be better leaders and stuff like that. I'm not sure if you have somewhat of a take like where you see the next 5-10 years when it comes more to like the leadership component, like how leaders perhaps will have to evolve, become better leaders, set better visions, anything like that.
There's a couple things I think about. They're probably not terribly exciting, but the first thing I think about is 10 years ago, leading a hybrid or remote workforce really was in the margin. It was a minor thing. So where we are today coming out of COVID is hybrid isn't going anywhere. If anything, hybrid is going to increase, not complete remote work, but we find that engagement and productivity increase when we allow people to go in and out of the office. There's a lot more complexity to that, but leading in a hybrid environment will continue to challenge leaders. Number two, this idea of DE&I, diversity, equity, inclusion. I don't know what's going to happen, but I do know this. Our demographics in Western culture, Europe and America specifically, aren't, again, going backwards. The diversity in the workforce and the diversity in the consumer force, the buying people, the buying public, it's not going away. It's ever increasing. We are an ever increasing melting pot. And to minimize and to not provide diverse and inclusive and equitable workplaces, I think is dangerous. And I think it's the wrong thing for us to be doing. I think leaders have to be equipped and prepared to manage teams and individuals that might sit in Israel and might sit in Canada. And in Israel, we might have a Ukrainian engineer sitting next to a Russian engineer. And that has to be dealt with. That's not a hypothetical situation. That, if not dealt with from a leadership standpoint and left to its own, can be quite corrosive to the culture, the team, and those individuals. I just use that as one illustration to say the importance of DE&I is far greater than I think the media or even the government give it, because it directly relates to employee engagement and productivity and performance. Period, full stop. This idea of, you mentioned artificial intelligence, and how will that take some menial tasks and it will frankly lead to job elimination? How will leaders leverage AI, not just in their service offerings and product offerings to increase them, but to drive up productivity, to remain an inclusive, humane workplace where this AI stuff can get a little fringy or sci-fi? So I just think, for me, I think hybrid, I think DE&I, I think artificial intelligence, and obviously the demographic changes, which I've touched on, are going to be forefront for leaders. The fundamentals of connecting to humans, helping humans be productive and perform at a high level and feel great about their work, that's going to remain. That's going to be a constant for leadership. But in the world that is changing so rapidly, I won't even say 10 years, I'll say 1 to 3 years, leaders have to be really agile, again, I'm going to say, in a growth mindset. What don't I know? How can I improve? Where am I doing something that is less than fully optimal for my people? And these are the kinds of thoughts that leaders are going to have ever-increasing comfort with complexity and comfort with not knowing the end state. And I think if we can get leaders in that growth mindset as a core fundamental principle, just like their security, just like lack of ignorance, I think we'll have more effective leaders as the world does change, because it's changing in really interesting and sometimes dangerous ways. And leaders in organizations have a big part to play in how we all consume the world.
Yeah, because it's like really evolving at like a really fast pace. And if you're a leader, you so much have to be like ahead of that and continuously like educate yourself, deal with complex problems, and just be like that person that people look up to. They're like, okay, like we're actually innovating. We're trying to get like ahead of the curve, and we're not just staying behind and just getting left behind, basically. But if you have someone actually forthcoming that wants to grow, trying to actually like learn new things, then you're going to be able to keep up with the pace, grow even more effectively. And one of the things that you mentioned, which I thought was interesting, is I probably would say like a year ago, like a lot of people were saying like, hey, if like remote, like we've seen like it works. We could literally, every company could take like their employees remote. But I'm somewhat seeing this like step back, where like a lot of companies, people want to have somewhat that like balance of being able to go remote, but also being able to like be in person. Because there is like that socializing concept that you have to be able to connect with people. And if you're just in front of a screen, it doesn't work like as effective. Like you need that little socializing touch, in my opinion.
Yeah, and well, it's not your opinion. The research is clear. The actual empirical research around productivity and employee engagement, innovation, culture, these are elements being studied by folks in my field. And turn on the Daily or NPR and you hear these vignettes about how the workforce has changed. Just real quick on that. Something called a curvilinear relationship with hours out of the office, right? So your gut, your opinion is right. When people have spaces to collaborate and talk about behavior and culture and team, innovation and productivity are positively enhanced. However, we're finding people, certainly people in your generation, as they enter the workforce, has an expectation of flexible work and an expectation of that commute that used to be an hour can be eliminated 2 or 3 days a week. These are things that drive up engagement as well. So it seems as though a balance in the hybrid is where optimal performance, culture, and engagement exists. Leaders being prepared to do that. Just think about before COVID. You say with AI, can you imagine a leadership team? Let's just use a cybersecurity company. There's many of them. One, pick one in the Bay Area. It doesn't make a difference. Pick a cybersecurity area. 2 years ago, someone in engineering R&D rang a bell and said, we have to develop our point of view on AI, and we have to make sure AI is baked into our actual hardware and software. Well, if I'm not evolved, then I'm in a growth mindset. If I'm not, what, tell me more. I don't know about this thing called AI or AL. Make it out. But so this idea that the world is changing incredibly rapidly and something's going to happen in 6 months or a year, it's going to impact us again with more changes because it just does. We need leaders that are agile, resilient, and willing to be vulnerable, learn, grow, and innovate.
I love that. And I guess like just before we wrap up here, one question, I guess I'm a bit curious about like your own like personal like leadership like journey. What has been, I guess like your biggest like learning moment as like your leader, and like how would you say it has somewhat impacted your approach actually like helping people and like supporting them in their own like leadership journey?
It's an interesting question. I don't know if I've had one moment. I've had a series of less than great leadership moments in my own life, that in my own firm, in my own personal life, that I'm human. So while I study this and practice it and help others, I am imperfect. In those imperfect moments where I've been able to open up and truly introspect and get outside in feedback and be willing to be wrong, to be embarrassed, frankly, those are the moments that have stuck to me. And I'll say a second thing around that. When I develop myself as a leader, I can't develop my leadership. It's a big cloud. It's big. But what I can develop is that specific point that I failed on. I was candid, but I wasn't respectful. I was decisive, but it wasn't inclusive. I said something that I thought was funny, and it turned out to hurt someone. These are moments that I can get pretty precise on. So I'm not grabbing a book in an airport to learn about leadership. I'm going to the academic world. I'm going to TED Talks. I'm going to books that are specifically around that pain point or that crucible where I let myself down or I let someone else down or I realize the cupboard is a little bit bare. Frankly, I made a mistake. And so when I've had these moments, I've welcomed them. They're painful, but I've been got to go chase down, as a competitor would, improvements in that area. That's kind of how I've viewed my own journey, so to speak.
Yeah, May I say last thing? Can I say one more thing?
Good.
Having a daughter. A very successful 19-year-old daughter. Anybody listening to this will know, being a parent very much informs your maturation and growth as a leader or manager. So be open to be challenged by your children and your family as well.
Yeah, I feel just like a continuous journey where you're like always learning, you're always becoming better. Something happens. I wouldn't say a failure, because I would see any failure being a lesson that you learn something and you can improve upon it. So when you run into these little things, then it's just about being able to improve on that, and overall, that's just how you get better as a leader here.
That's right.
Perfect. Well said.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on, Michael. And if there's like anyone that would want to get in touch with you, hear more about you, is there like a best way to get in touch with you there? Or
thank you for asking. BrainerdStrategy.com. That's BrainerdStrategy.com. Also on YouTube, we have a channel, Brainerd Strategy, and that would have tons of content, old, medium, new. And through BrainerdStrategy.com, our website, you can get all of our details on how to get in touch with me directly.
Perfect. We'll add that into the description if anyone wants to find that, so you don't have to type everything. But perfect. Really appreciate your time, Michael, here.